This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make?
Go!
The answer is 13. But did you see the moonwalking bear?
Go!
Who got 13? Did anyone count 13? Who saw the moonwalking bear? Oh, a couple of people. Yeah, it's a good one, isn't it? You're so focused on counting the number of the throws that you miss the crazy moonwalking bear that comes through. Have you ever heard the phrase, you can't see the forest for the trees? Now, there's a couple of different ways people take this. It technically means that you're so caught up in the details that you miss the big picture. Or sometimes people will just say that you're so focused that you can't even realize when you see the tree that that means that there is a forest there. You miss something obvious. When was the last time for you that you missed something obvious? Like maybe you look back later on and you go, how did I not see that? How was that not just as clear as day? But actually at the time, I missed it. Why did you miss it? There might be lots of different answers to that, but as this little video shows, one of the main reasons we miss the obvious is we're actually looking for something else. That we're actually not able to step back and see the bigger picture because we're so focused in on the small or the exact or the detail that we miss the big thing that might be exactly what we're looking for when it comes along. We're continuing our series looking at the road to the cross. It's our Easter series as we draw towards remembering what Jesus did for us when he died on the cross. And we're looking at some different perspectives. So last week, we looked at the disciples' perspective. What was it like for the disciples? That they started following Jesus and they didn't know he was the Messiah. They thought he was just a rabbi that was going to teach them how to be a good Jew. But then as they journeyed after him, they learned and saw Jesus in a new light. This week, we're asking this question. We're looking at the Jewish leaders. And the question we're asking is, and in case you didn't know this is true, why did the Jewish leaders have such a hard time with Jesus? Why is it that throughout the story of the New Testament, throughout the story of Jesus, time and time again, Jesus seems to be clashing with the Jewish leaders. And the Jewish leaders are getting angry and upset and frustrated that Jesus doesn't do things the way that they're expecting. So why is that? What is it about the story of Jesus? And what can we learn about the person of Jesus and maybe even our own faith? Maybe even our own practice. Maybe we can learn from what happens with the Jewish leaders to make sure that something similar doesn't happen for us. But to get started with, you might see the phrase Jewish leaders and go, oh, that's a really easy thing. Like, obviously, there was a clear group of people who were the Jewish leaders. Well, actually, there are so many different kinds of people within the New Testament that fit that role that I just want to give you a bit of an outline of what the different kinds of Jewish leader might be, what it is about them, how you might see it, because as you read through, there are actually lots of different groups. One of the groups you might read about are the Pharisees. So the Pharisees say this, or the Pharisees did that, or yada, yada, yada. Now, Pharisees are lay people. It doesn't mean they lie down. It means that it's not professional. They're not paid. They're just average Joes who do a day job and those sort of things, but they take the law really seriously. They're effectively a religious party. So they would affiliate with the Pharisees, and the Pharisees have a particular view of the law and a particular interpretation of how should the law be read, how should the law be taken. But they're not paid. They're not professional. They are just everyday people who would subscribe to being a Pharisee. Another group which is connected but isn't the same are the scribes and the teachers of the law. Now, this is a profession. These are the lawyers. Oh, no. These are the lawyers. Sorry, any lawyers out there? Actually, we're working with a lawyer at the moment who's doing a really good job, so I shouldn't say that because he's actually really helping us a lot. These are the teachers of the law, the scribes. They're lawyers. Their job, they're paid to some degree, or their profession, to interpret Jewish law. Now, it is common for a Pharisee to be a scribe, but when they're calling themselves a Pharisee, they're not calling upon their profession, they're calling upon their interest in being a Pharisee. So there is a difference there, and so there are different times when it might say, Jesus met with the teachers of the law. That is actually talking about meeting with a profession, whereas when it's the Pharisees, it's a group of lay people. Now, there's another group of people, in case you weren't already confused enough, called the chief priests or the priests. They work in the temple. They get their livelihood by serving in the temple, overseeing Jewish religious life, overseeing temple life, all those sort of things. These people are very, very wealthy. Almost always, without doubt, they are incredibly well off. Pharisees, not necessarily. Pharisees might be a mix of things. Generally speaking, Pharisees aren't rich. But the chief priests and the priests, the temple does pretty well because everybody has to contribute and they're in charge of how that goes. And so this is a group of people who are paid to oversee religious life. Now there's another group within that mix called the Sadducees. You remember how to, by sad, you see. That's one of the ways that I was taught to say it, because you don't know how to pronounce it. They are the ruling elite. These are priests. So oftentimes your chief priests and your priests would also be Sadducees, but not necessarily only that. These are your ruling elite, your priests, your aristocrats, your merchants. This is the top end of town. And they would be part of the Sadducees. Kind of, again, similar to a lay group, except that, again, they're a bit more wealthy in that case. So you'll get your Pharisees and your Sadducees interacting together about Jesus, but you won't see them interacting together about much else because they actually are quite diametrically opposed in every other area. So there's kind of two groups within that. You've got your Pharisees, scribes, and teachers of the law, which will often be the same. You've got your chief priests and your Sadducees that get drawn together. They're often the same. And all of these are what are referred to as the Jewish leaders within the Bible. So when you come across any of these phrases, Pharisee, scribe, teacher of the law, chief priest, priest, or a Sadducee, that's what the writers of the New Testament are talking about. But just be aware that they're not all one group. It's actually only really around the person and the role of Jesus that they have any point of unity. So I wonder why that is. Now, one of the reasons for that is that Jesus directly challenged their rules and their way of living. They might have disagreed on what that actually was themselves, but Jesus found a way to actually challenge them almost across the board. And there were some things about the way they went about it which was really difficult for them to kind of come to because he didn't act in the way they expected him to. In the awareness test, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law and the scribes were looking for the number 13 and Jesus was the moonwalking bear, if you will. And they missed it because he didn't meet what they were looking for. They thought they were looking for the Messiah. They thought they were looking for the way of God, and they thought they'd found it and knew it. But they missed it. And part of the reason for this is actually how their approach to following God was, and one of the key distinctions of how we sort of take things versus what they do. So there's what was called the written Torah. Now, for those of you who know your Christian Bible, that's just the first five books of the Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In their world, that was called the Torah. It had some of those names as well, but that was a collection of scrolls that was written down, and that was the law that was to be followed. But there was another arm that was equally important to the Jewish leaders. And this is where all of the trouble came. It was called the Oral Torah. Now, if you go back to that time, the vast majority of people couldn't read. The vast majority, it was only really those elite, the Sadducees, the ruling nations, maybe some of the other Jewish leaders would have had the capacity, but the average everyday person could not read. So you weren't able to actually teach them to follow the law by teaching them just to read. There was a whole lot of rules and laws that had been taught by oral teaching. And so you memorized this oral teaching. And it was an interpretation of the written Torah. And in many cases, you would actually know the oral Torah better than the written Torah, because you trusted that those who were teaching you the oral Torah understood the written, and so they would express to you what you needed to know, and you would memorize it, and that's how you would follow it. Later, this is what became known as the Talmud. If you ever hear about a Jewish person talking about the Talmud, or the Mishnah, or the Gemara, if you haven't heard any of those, just go home tonight and go to sleep. You don't need to worry about it. It's not that important. But in case you ever do come across those words, all they are is a written version that came later. So later on, they went, you know what, maybe we should write these oral things down. And so the Talmud, which was a mix of the Mishnah and the Gemara, were written down. And that's now what's passed on in today's. And today's Jewish people will follow the Talmud, and they will follow the Torah. But it's an important distinction, because as followers of Jesus, we take the first five books of the Old Testament very seriously, and they are taken as being a representation of God's law to us. But much of the oral Torah is not expressed, it's not necessarily included within our scriptures, and that's where most of the points of contention came from. So let's just go through a couple of those briefly. Firstly, what are you allowed to do on the Sabbath? Well, there's what the written Torah said, which was just to honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. And there's a few places that express and explain what you can and can't do. But on the whole, it basically just said, keep it holy. Keep it, don't work on that day. And now the oral Torah came along and gave very specific explanations of what you could and couldn't do, down to things like how many steps are you allowed to take. Yes, they had step counters back then. They weren't electronic. You had to do it in your head. But they had step counters because they needed to know on the Sabbath, have I taken 60 steps or 61 steps? Because, oh my goodness, I'm breaking the Sabbath if I've taken too many steps. That was a oral Torah understanding of it. So Jesus regularly healed people on the Sabbath, and healing was considered to be work. You don't heal on the Sabbath because that's work. That's not in the written Torah, that was in the oral Torah. And so Jesus clashed with them because he said, of course we're going to do mercy. If your mule falls into the mud, you pull it out. So Jesus clashed with them about what they could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. Ceremonial hand washing. Now, this is one of the ones that challenges us today, because we know that washing hands is good, yeah? Yeah, washing hands is a good idea. They didn't have germ theory back then. Their hand washing was a ceremonial hand washing. It actually wasn't about being actually clean. It was about the ceremony behind it. And Jewish custom, what had been brought up over time, required very specific washing before eating. It was an elaborate process that you would follow. And Jesus and his disciples were regularly called out not following this process. And that caused all kinds of grief for those who were the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they're looking and going, look what you're doing. You're not following the oral Torah. You're not following the understanding, the teachings of the leaders. You've missed it. And that got them into all kinds of trouble. Using the temple courts. And so one of the things that was going on at the time was the temple courts were used to sell things. There was all kinds of markets because everyone had to go to the temple anyway. So while you're here, buy one now, get one later. Yeah, that's a great opportunity. Yeah, they're going to come to the temple anyway, so let's go where the people are and we'll sell our wares. And Jesus comes in and he clears the temple. It's where you see Jesus is most angry. And he is angry. He is actually angry in that time. It's a righteous anger. There's all kinds of conversations that we can have there and we might at a later date. But he clears the temple. How dare they return this place of God's presence? into a marketplace. Now, here's the thing that we have to remember, because the Jewish leaders do get a little bit of a bung rap. They get a bit of a backhanded slap at times, and they get talked down a lot. But Jesus isn't entirely against them. In Matthew 5:20, we read this, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." That's a pretty high bar. That, unless your righteousness, so he actually calls them righteous in this point. He can see that actually many of the things they're presenting is accurate, that some of the heart behind what they're doing is actually close to God. So Jesus challenges and says, don't just write those Pharisees off. Actually have a look at it, because if you're not as righteous as them, you'll miss it. Now, there's a reason for that, and Jesus will come along later and die on the cross and make it about not our own righteousness, but about his own. But he points out, actually, don't completely just miss them. Matthew 23, verse 1 to 3, he says this. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." This is an important seat. "So you must be careful to do everything they tell you." Hang on a second, but what about? Oh, we'll come to that. "But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach." So he does draw a distinction. Okay, listen carefully to what they say, because they talk a good game, but they don't follow through. Hypocrites! Hypocrites! You blind fools! Jesus uses some fun words. Listen, but make sure you actually do. Because they don't. Now, I like this about Jesus, and I like this in general. Jesus wasn't afraid to call a spade a spade. He was blunt at times. You read through it and go, you know what, if I was to be Jesus there, I might have done it. It's like, he calls it as it is at times. The dinner invitation, I love this one. Luke chapter 11, verse 37 to 40, and then a couple of verses later. The dinner invitation that went badly. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee, so there's that, that's who we're talking about, a group of lay people, invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table. Typical to be done at the time. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees, you clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people." And that word foolish, it's not actually very strong to us, but that's a big word in the culture. Did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? And then following on to this is that big line of woe, 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 woe to you, you hypocrites, woe to you. And he absolutely just lands on them. Now, what's going on here? They want to be seen to be doing right. So they wash and they have these elaborate ceremonies, but their hearts are cold and bitter. They put on a show to be seen by others, but what's inside is not as it should be. So here's the question that's important for us to always be wrestling with. And if you're exploring faith, this is a really hard one. But even if you've been on the journey with Jesus for some time, this can be a good one to remind us. Are you looking for the Jesus that is, or for the Jesus that you want there to be? One of the challenges we have in following Jesus is there's a bit of a wrestle that goes on. God is trying to turn you to become the person he made you to be. And yet, just like Adam and Eve in the garden and many people throughout history, we try and turn God to be the God that we want him to be. We try and make Jesus fit the mold of how we think Jesus should work and operate. And it's easy for us to look at the Pharisees and go, how did they miss it so badly? But what they did is exactly what we can do If we don't open our minds to see the Jesus that is, and instead we try and fit him into the mold of who we expect him to be and how we expect him to act. And then when he doesn't do what we expect him to, when there's something going on in our life and there's a circumstance that we go, if God would just do X, we actually take on the role of the Pharisees or the Sadducees or the teachers of the law because he isn't doing what we see him to do. Are we looking for the Jesus that is? Are we open to seeing the Jesus that's there? Or are we going to fight on and insist on looking for the Jesus that we want there to be? So in what ways do we risk the error of the Jewish leaders? One of the maxims that I really do subscribe to, it's an old Church of Christ one. Sorry, Baptists. Some of my heritage will come out from time to time. But then it's not only Church of Christ, there are other denominations that have used it, but that's the context that I learned it in. I really do think this is a helpful phrase. In the essentials, we fight for unity. In the non-essentials, we express liberty. And at all times, we have a charitable disposition towards the person we're discussing or fighting or trying to work things out with. What does that mean? Well, the essentials generally boil down to the things about the person and the role of Jesus Christ. It's the things that in the early days the creeds were all written about. What were those really big things that we have to make sure that all churches are on the same page around? They're those things that we must have unity on. But there's a number of things that, and this is actually a Baptist principle, that each individual Christian has to have their own conscience around most of the other things. Does that make them right and wrong just because someone believes it? No. Part of the gathering is that actually we should be refined by one another and that we should challenge one another. But ultimately, a healthy church is going to have a diverse range of religious belief. That actually on many items, there are going to be people who call a church home who disagree on a number of matters, but it's the essentials that bring us together. One of the troubles that the Pharisees had and the Sadducees had and the teachers of the law and the scribes is they had a very specific view, and if you did not meet that view, you could not be one of them. And Jesus didn't fit their lens. So one of the challenges, and it is a wrestle because I want you all to believe what I believe because I'm right. And you laugh because you're, oh, you know you're not, but you're wrong. But genuinely, we want people to believe what we believe because if we didn't think we were right, we wouldn't believe it. We would change to the other perspective. And it's only in recognizing those things. Now, there are some things that I will fight for. Jesus was a literal, real person. He lived, he died, he rose again in physical form and went to be with the Father. And he will return to call us to be with him. I'm not ceding ground on any one of those points. There's a whole host of other things that churches debate and argue, and they will, and it's appropriate to. But the error of the Jewish leaders was to be so focused on their exact and specific viewpoint that even Jesus himself didn't fit the mold. So here's my encouragement to you. And this might be a bit unsettling for some because you like it black and white and it's just like, this is the way it is. I encourage you to foster a healthy curiosity and appropriate doubt. Debilitating doubt doesn't serve anyone. But actually sitting just a little bit on edge about your convictions, just having a little bit of an openness around them, actually will serve you well. Because you will be able to engage in conversations with other Christians with an open heart and an open mind and an open attitude that actually might be what draws them to see things the way that you see them. So a healthy curiosity. I wonder why I believe what I believe. I wonder if something about my background or my history has led me to think this. I wonder what if there was another way. And appropriate doubt in the mix. So I want to end with another story. And it's the curious case of Nicodemus. I love the story of Nicodemus because it doesn't go the way that the rest of the story seems to go. In John chapter 3, verse 1 to 2, we see this. Now, there was a Pharisee. Okay, that's the line of person we're talking about. Layperson, stickler for the letter of the law. Really, really focused on it. A man named Nicodemus, who was a member of the Jewish ruling council. So there's a ruling council that he's a part of as a Pharisee. He came to Jesus at night because he can't be seen with Jesus. Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God. Firstly, I wonder who the we is. Interesting. We know that you are a teacher who's come from God. For no one could perform the signs you were doing if God were not with him. But he comes to him at night because he can't be seen with Jesus. That would not go down well with the group of people he's around. In John 7, we pick up the story of Nicodemus again, and it says this. Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus earlier, and who was one of their own number, so this is again the Jewish ruling council, this is where it's happening. Does our law condemn a man without first hearing him to find out what he's been doing? They replied, "Are you from Galilee too? Look into it and you will find that a prophet does not come out of Galilee." Now, there's a whole lot more context to that story. So if you want to know what that is, go and have a look at it. Go read it, John chapter 7. But Nicodemus actually at this point, and this is now not nighttime, he's taken a step towards Jesus. And he stands up in the council and says, "You're looking to condemn a man and you haven't even heard the story. You don't even know what's going on." And they reply and say, "It can't be right. He's from Galilee. What are you doing? You're missing it." Interesting where Nicodemus is going. Then in John chapter 19, this is a doozy. Jesus has died. He's given his life. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, because he feared the Jewish leaders. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who had earlier had visited Jesus at night. Such an essential little point. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes. And if you've ever read this before and you don't know pounds, which, you know, I don't, or certainly not in the context of these things, I don't know how big myrrh is and how big aloes are. I'm completely oblivious to that. About 75 pounds. Okay, I would guess that was probably a fair amount because it sounds pretty big. That was about $100,000 worth of myrrh and aloes. And this is the lowest amount. This is the conservative figure. Some suggest it was up to $250,000 worth used to embalm Jesus. Nicodemus, a member of the Pharisees, a member of the ruling council, he met Jesus. It changed his life. And when Jesus died, we don't get the rest of the story. If I was writing the Bible, I would make sure you got all of the endings of all these little trains of thought that come across, but we don't. But there actually was hope for any member of the Jewish leading people, because Nicodemus is one of them. And he, along with Joseph, invested in ensuring that Jesus' body was cared for. Anyone, maybe you've got some friends, maybe you've got some people who they're kind of like a Pharisee but against the Christian faith. You know the ones. Or they're like a Sadducee against the Christian faith. And you're like, how can anything break through there? Nicodemus is actually an encouragement that in time, and as they see what's going on, what was the key thing Nicodemus said? You must be from God, because there's no way that what has been going on, no way that what has happened could have happened unless God was in it. So let's be careful as a church not to fall into the error of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the teachers of the law and the scribes and the prophets and all of those. They missed the Messiah that they were looking for because they were so caught up in their exact specific expectations. Healthy curiosity, healthy doubt, and journeying together. One of the Baptist distinctives, one of the things which is so important, is congregational governance. We actually believe that the collective will is greater than the individual. And that in coming together, in learning what it means to make decisions together, we will hear the will of God. We don't talk about being Baptist an awful lot because it's not, again, is it about being Baptist? No, of course not. That's why I could go from being Church of Christ to being Baptist and it didn't really cause an awful lot of challenge because that's not an essential for me. Being Baptist is not essential. But there are some strengths, I believe, to the approach. In essentials, unity. In the non-essentials, diversity. And in all times and always, whenever you have an interaction with a follower of Jesus, bring a spirit of charity. Because that is not what we experience outside. When you have discussions, when you have debates, when you have a falling out or a disagreement, fight for that spirit of charity. You can't make the other side bring it. But you can fight to bring it yourself. Don't miss what is right there. Don't miss the Jesus that is. Because he doesn't meet the Jesus that you want there to be. Look for the Jesus that is. Follow him. Let's pray. I pray as we come towards Easter, Lord, that you would help us to remember you as you were, the sacrifice that you made, the life that you lived, and the promises that you make. I pray for our friends and family who may not know you. Maybe they've been put off by the Jesus that they've seen presented to them. Maybe they've been put off by things that have happened in their life. And they don't want to see the Jesus that is. I pray that somehow, whether it's this week or in the future, you would help us to draw them to see what we have seen, to meet the Jesus that those of us who call Jesus Lord, that we've met and that we know. Lord, for anyone who might be here today who's exploring faith, I pray that you would make yourself known to them and that they would see you and they would know you and they would come to follow you as you are. Help us as a church to be a church that journeys with people towards you, we pray. In Jesus' name.